Welcome to Voice Rising with Kara Johnstad. Enjoy weekly conversations with leading luminaries, pioneering visionaries, singers, poets, musicians, and sound healers as we explore the profound role our voice plays on the path to self-realization and global enlightenment. The internationally acclaimed singer, composer, author, healer, recording artist, voice expert, creator of Voice Your Essence, and founder of the School of Voice, Kara Johnstad, uses her extraordinary spiritual gifts to empower others. Everything in this world vibrates. Everything has a frequency. A pioneer in the field of voice work and transformational songwriting. Her breakthrough methods are helping thousands of people worldwide fine-tune their body-mind-spirit system and unlock the energetic frequencies of limitless creativity, health, and abundance. Share your voice, ask your questions, join in the conversation. Receive life-changing, positive transformation and rise together to create a sound world. And here's your host, Kara Johnstad.
Hello, everybody. A very warm welcome to the show. My guest today is Mark Nepo, who has moved and inspired readers and seekers all over the world with his number one New York Times bestseller, The Book of Awakening. And he is so beloved as a poet, as a teacher, and as a storyteller. He has been called an impassioned seeker, an eloquent spiritual teacher, and his work is widely accessible and used by many, and his books have been translated into more than 20 languages. This is book number 23 that we're going to talk about today, and what can I say? It's called Surviving the Storms, Finding the Strength to Meet Adversity, and we need this wisdom now more than ever. Welcome, Mark, to Voice Rising.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be with you again.
It is so good to have you back, and especially with the new book, which I've devoured, basically. Or I don't know if I could say I devoured it. It's like I savored it. I ate it in small chunks, right? And
yes.
And it just seems like every page has golden nuggets of wisdom. So let's just start, which is, you know, where the title of your book is. There are storms everywhere. We are in, well, I guess we are in turbulent times, and like every generation, we have to find our way. We have to navigate through these storms. And in this new book, you actually address exactly what predicament we're in, and you give us some ideas on how we can get through these storms together. So what are you exploring in this new book? What was your thesis for yourself?
Yeah, you know, so, and each book is a teacher for me. You know, I learn, this is the way that I learn, is through this kind of inquiry, and I just happen to write it down and then become a student of what comes forward. And and this book, you know, I began before the pandemic, but of course was greatly informed by the pandemic, which heightened so many of the struggles in our modern world. So I think, you know, and I use a metaphor, you know, early in the book about the metaphor of redwood trees, these magnificent trees in the West Coast of the United States. They're, you know, they're, some of them are 1,000 years old. They're hundreds of feet high, and, you know, you can't even wrap your arms around the trunks. They're so enormous. And, you know, even with climate change, those trees can be damaged, but I doubt that they could be uprooted. And that's because their roots are strong and their trunks are wide. And in fact, their roots are connected underground. Mm. And this is a tremendous metaphor for why we need a inner life, a spiritual practice, and why we need each other. Because we need to strengthen our roots, connect our roots, and widen our trunks to endure the storms of our time. And you know, so this led me to, you know, and we'll get into that, into the nature of storms, because there are all, you know, every, from actual storms, you know, geological storms, weather storms, to the internal storms, the relational storms, the cultural storms of our time. And, you know, I think one of the things that was a moment that really opened the book for me was in the beginning of the pandemic, and I think other people who've been through life-threatening situations probably felt the same thing. You know, I'm going to be 72 next week. When I met someone my age when I was younger, I thought they were ancient.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. It doesn't seem so old now. And but in my 30s, as you know, I almost died from a rare form of lymphoma. And so there was a moment that came back to me so vividly at the beginning of the pandemic from my cancer journey. And this was the moment I was diagnosed. I had a tumor, large tumor growing in my skull bone. And I went to a doctor, of course. And after, you know, a certain inquiry, I was told I had cancer and a rare form of cancer. And of course, I was frightened and undone. And, you know, and I wanted to say, are you sure you have the right folder? Is you sure it's me? And it, of course it was. And but the moment was that after that diagnosis, the door I had come through to keep that appointment was gone. There was no way back to life before that appointment. And this came to me so vividly at the beginning of the pandemic because I feel the pandemic has done this to all of humanity. The old world is gone. There is no going back. There are parts of our society that want to deny that it's changed, want to be angry, want to blame somebody. It's gone, and the only way is to love each other forward.
Oh, that's beautiful, to love each other forward. And with this loss is also a grief. And I know this sensation, though, too, because I live in Berlin, Germany. And when the wall fell, it was a similar thing. It was different, but it was similar that the whole East was experiencing more loss because everybody wanted it to become modernized and westernized. And they weren't thinking very well about integration. And that meant that there's a lot of grief work that often was not done, right? And in this hope, actually, of the newness of it all, but still they were losing conditionings or identities, or they were feeling that what they had lived wasn't sufficient, or, you know, all these things. And so we're really being asked to grieve the loss and share with us how love and loss are so intricately linked together.
Well, yes, and this is archetypal. You know that, one of the things when we talk about this, which because it is a constant paradox that the loss cannot be and the grief cannot be skipped over. It is very human, and it is a teacher all by itself. And the loss excavates unknown new territory to be lived, and new gifts. You know, I use reference to this, the beautiful reference to, there was a samurai in the 1600s in Japan. His name was Masahide. And after a long, successful career as a very expert samurai, he suddenly put down his sword and walked away. And searched out the great poet Basho so he could apprentice with him to become a poet. Boy, I would have loved to talk to that guy. What happened?
Right.
the one haiku that he is known for is profound in regards to what we're talking about. His one haiku that's so profound goes like this: my barn having burned to the ground, I can see the moon more completely. My barn having burned to the ground, I can see the moon more completely. And so, you know, this archetypal, this paradox, the grief is there. There's no minimizing the loss of the barn. We can imagine it could be a family barn. He could have built it himself. But, and once the barn is leveled, oh my God, there's this vastness I had no idea was there.
Right. And so which question do you think the pandemic is asking us to lean into?
Well, I think the pandemic, like other things at different, you know, this is very, this is, I feel like, and then I'll speak to that, but every generation, this is our turn.
Yeah.
The pandemic is the specifics for us, but you know, in my parents' generation, it was World War II,
exactly.
You know, in other generations, it was other challenging, incredible, unprecedented things. And it's our turn. Are we going to choose love over fear? Are we going to recognize that we're more together than alone, or insist on self-interest? You know, how are we going to do this time?
How are we going to raise the next barn in a way together, right? Together, if we know
yes.
how to raise barns in a community,
yes,
how they used to be
connection.
Built, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, one thing about the pandemic was that we were forced to be still and for several years. And I mean, it's passing, but it's still not gone. But, you know, the word Sabbath in the Jewish tradition literally means the one day we don't turn one thing into another.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel the pandemic has forced us into a global Sabbath. Has forced us to be with the miracle of what is. We can't dream. We, you know, for a while there, we couldn't scheme, we couldn't dream, we couldn't manipulate, we couldn't go here, go there. We had to be with what is.
Forced, on one hand, it forced the stillness, but it also, at least here, there was a lot of isolation. You know, people that couldn't see their parents who they loved, children that were masked in school. We had lockdowns. Nobody was singing. The community meeting was very, very hard. And I think that's also part of understanding. You talk in your book about the alienation. You even write about that Karl Marx said that
yes.
an estranged and divided society breeds estranged and divided citizens, right? And you're talking about the alienation, which I think, in a way, the pandemic offered us a stillness to not keep on running, and to just, more people started cooking their own meals, more people started gardening, more people, I have a friend, she's a frame drummer, more people started to learn a music instrument, right? Because they didn't know what to do. And at the same time, there was this technology where people were, in some ways closer maybe on social media, but also alienated from each other because they weren't going to the markets, they weren't going to the choirs, they weren't going to the community centers, and they weren't even able to visit their mother in the nursing home. And that's also quite a thing to realize, that you can't be physically close to the people that you love. And how can we spiritually still create a practice, you know, through meditation or through writing beautiful poetry? How can we still stay connected to the people that we love?
Well, absolutely. Right? Yeah, I mean, I think, and to touch on the connection there, you know, in the beginning of the book that I spent some time giving my guess at how we are globally where we are today, and that alienation, and you know, that's one of the fault lines that goes back to the Industrial Revolution, and you know, as I try to explore there, and refer to Karl Marx, you know, at the Industrial Revolution, and Marx, too, he did not really say, let's get rid of progress. He was looking for how do we compensate for these spiritual liabilities of progress. And so one of the things that began to happen, and then we can look at what technology has done. But so one of the things that happened back in the Industrial Revolution was, up until that time, for the most part, people worked where they lived.
Yes.
People worked with their family. People, and whatever we worked on, was an entire process. So there were, you know, whether it was farming from seed to harvest, or whether I was a cobbler and I made shoes from cutting the leather to actually stitching it and then making the laces and putting on the heels, we were involved in an entire process. So we experienced wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Industrial Revolution began the presence of factories. And now for the first time, no, people left home to work. In fact, wound up spending a majority of their time away from home. So relationship was broken. And then once they were working in factories, they were no longer allowed to experience wholeness because for efficiency's sake, no, you just make the laces. Don't you worry mm-hmm. about the rest mm-hmm. of the shoe. So this was all good for the god of practicality and efficiency, the god of capitalism, but it was not good for the human spirit. And what Marx recognized precociously, you know, Marx often gets a bad rap because Marx didn't create Marxism, dictators did.
Yeah,
he had
yeah.
some pretty amazing insights, and this was one of them, that he foresaw that, you know, if we have enough people separated from their basic human nature, you will have an alienation.
Mm-hmm.
And he coined that term, alienation, and he foresaw the first generation of therapists, he called them alienists, and saw their mm-hmm. job as repairing people to their wholeness, to
amazing.
Their relationship to life and each other. Boy, don't we need that today?
And we also have a huge field of many, many therapists that are working very hard to heal people from addiction. Not only from, you know, the normal diseases, but there are many therapists that are working and striving towards mending and healing and bringing families together. And
I've often felt that therapy, psychotherapy, which literally means, the words mean attention to the soul.
Mm.
We in the modern world have pathologized it. Oh, you're going to a therapist? Oh, you know, something must be mm-hmm. wrong with mm-hmm. you. And like we do aerobics, we go to the gym regularly. I think, you know, alongside phys ed in high school should be therapy, continual therapy. Who doesn't want to give attention to the soul? We don't have to wait for something to break. Let's just arc for a moment to where we are today and how the Industrial Revolution has morphed into the technological world. And so, you know, we have that. So with all the technology and all the iPads and phones and everything, and they're great tools. I don't want to be without those tools. Look how we're talking continents mm-hmm. away and through these tools. But if we don't have an inner life, it doesn't mean we have things figured out. If we don't have an inner, authentic life in which we're inquiring into the reverence of life, well, then technology, like water filling a hole, will become our default values. Then, and what are those characteristics of technology? Well, it moves very fast when things that matter take time. It happens in many places at once, so you're never where you are. In fact, you feel like you're missing. You know, one of the great menacing assumptions of the modern world is that life is other than where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything I learned from almost dying is there is no there, there's only here.
And only there now, is, more probably.
And only now. And so when we have these, when I'm sitting with my cell phone or my iPad and I'm online or I'm surfing or whatever, I think I'm alone, but I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm in a digital netherworld. I'm not in relationship and I'm not in solitude. And it reminds me of, you know, Rilke, the great Rilke. One of his lines in one of his poems is, I was alone, but not alone enough to make every moment holy.
That's a fantastic line. Yeah. Yeah. Rilke lived a few blocks away from the house that I live in.
Oh, my God.
And also Kafka lived around the corner. And so sometimes when I'm walking, I think, oh, isn't that really wonderful? You're walking in the same Grunewald, you know, I'm walking in the same woods as all these, you know, live the
Christians. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And I actually came to Berlin with Letters to a Young Poet. There's something that really, I had it in my back pocket, you know, the whole time, because, I don't know, Krishnamurti, Rilke, they were all in my back pocket in my little suitcase. At that time, there wasn't online, there weren't any online shops, so you carried your books with you, and you actually often, at least if you were a writer or a poet or somebody, you know, your suitcase would be full of books because you couldn't get the English books in Europe that easily at that time. I mean, of course you could in Great Britain, but I was in Germany. And then you had these, you know, these really beautiful, The Little Prince was also with me when I moved from the States. And then you had these gems, and Rilke is one of those. He's just one of those gems, right? He's just.
Oh, he is. What a rich back pocket you had.
I did. I had a very rich pocket and with early 20s. So I feel fortunate to have had those people on the journey. How can we get more? I mean, I guess that's what you said. I'm losing the line now that you said so beautifully of Rilke, but it's like we're connected. What did you say? We're alone, but not alone enough.
He said, I am alone, but not alone enough to make every moment holy. And so what this raises, which, and you know, I don't have any answers. I always like to say what I share are examples, not instructions. We're just taking notes together about what it is to be here in our time. And so, you know, I think that one of the struggles that's very acute in the modern world is that we have become divorced from reality. We have become estranged from our human nature. And so I think one of the kind of imperatives is to repair our direct connection to life. Because when we have a direct connection to life, and all the traditions, you know, all their practices, various, are all to help us return to this direct sanctity of life. Because when we do experience that, whether we go for a walk in nature, or we're authentically tender and real with each other, or we're truly listening to music, where it unlaces our heart, whatever it might be, where we're so present, once we are reconnected with life, we rediscover our reverence for life. And if we have reverence for life, we can't do harm. And
there is no violence, right? I want to ask you this question, because, I mean, it comes with reverence and truth, and it, I mean, also this whole idea of the technology world is so quick. We just push the button to get the answer. But actually, you know, like Rilke said, you know, live the questions, and maybe someday, not like, okay, you know, what is a storm? Click. You may live into the answers, right? But authenticity is a big one. Slowing down is a big one. Suspending judgment is a big one. What are some other ways that we can repair and mend and bring things back together so that we feel this wholeness?
So I think that, you know, that what you just mentioned are eternal practices that each of us need to inhabit very personally. So we can touch on these things, but there's no how-to. There's no manual. Mm-hmm. We have to each look in our lives and inhabit it in a very particular way. So anyone who's listening, if anything we're saying speaks to you, I encourage you to see where it lives in your life. Where and how can you suspend judgment? Because why? Because judgment is the clearest wall we can build. Mm. Judgment is a clear wall. So we go around with a wall that looks like we don't have any wall, and yet we're more enclosed than ever.
Yeah.
And isolated. And so listening and being present, and what does it mean to be present? Well, again, I can share, you know, for me, It's a constant commitment to lean into life, especially when the difficulties of life push me away. That's when I need to lean in the most, when fear and pain and worry push me away like surf coming in. I've got to lean back in. And that's a quiet courage, you know, suspending our judgment. So, you know, one very particular practice I have is when I feel very strongly about something, before I voice it as a statement or a declaration, I turn it around and reflect on it as a question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to move off my certainty. To move off my certainty. You know, I think that, and when I am confused and troubled, and we all are because we're human. So wisdom is not a shortcut to this life. It's a resource. Doesn't matter how many books I've read or how many I've retrieved and written or what I've learned and whatever wisdom I might have or might not have, it doesn't prevent me from getting off this call and tripping on the stoop and having adrenaline and feeling fear.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Feeling worry. But how do I hold that? Why these roots that are deep? Why spirit is so important? Let me use a metaphor of the ocean, of water here, because it is the depth that right-sizes the agitation of life. So if you look at any body of water, the ocean, great big, you know, sea or a bay, but let's say the ocean, well, it's all one water. We look at the surface, we go, oh, those are nice waves.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all one water. You can't tell where the wave stops and the deep begins. So that's the first thing. So now in the metaphor I want to offer, take the top foot or 8 inches of any body of water. It is always disturbed by weather, sometimes gently, sometimes harshly. It's rarely unmoved or unrippled.
Mm-hmm.
That top foot is our psychology. It is the part of our spirit that meets the world every day. It will always be in interaction and relationship and disturbed by the weather of circumstance. Sometimes they're wonderful things, sometimes they're difficult things. Again, it's all one water. And if we only stay in our psychology, we'll be bounced around like a pinball in a pinball machine.
Yeah,
it will be very difficult. But if we can't help but be in the world, so that top is going to be there. But if we allow ourselves at the same time to enter the depth of our spirit and our heart and our being, well, we know what happens when you go down into the depths. Things move slower. The edge of that agitation, it's not denied, it's right-sized. And it makes the unbearable bearable. This is why we need a spiritual practice. And even knowing this, there are days when I might be caught in a mood of fear. And even with all I know, I can't shake it. Then I've got to call you up and say, I can't shake it today. Can you help me?
Mm.
You're my friend. Can you help? So I think one thing that's very important too is to ask for help. You know, this is not in this book, but I'm working on a chapter in a new book that's called The Endless Vows, where these four simple vows help restore our wholeness, our connection to life, our reverence for life. They're very simple, but if inhabited in a real way, they never fail. And they are help, thank you, I'm sorry, I love you.
Yeah. It reminds me today, I heard exactly this line. It was actually Gabor Mate was talking about how every child comes to the world and knows how to ask for help. They know intuitively how to reach out, and if they don't have that listening ear, and if they feel sadness, or let's say they scrape their knee and they're crying, and then somebody says, "Hey, it's okay, get over it. You know, it was no big deal," or whatever, and they stop trusting. Then a lot of people, they continue to go out into the world and have to bear the pain, or they believe they have to go through it all alone. And it's not that they don't have friends, but it's hard for them even to ask for the help of the community, which is so important, right? We can only raise the barn together. We can only even put in a light bulb sometimes together, at least in my big apartment, right? We need each other. And to allow ourselves to feel that is an honor if someone asks us actually to share.
And to bear witness. What you're saying, to bear witness and to honor. Honor is one of the words I love, because it has stayed, a lot of words erode over time, just mm-hmm. like nature. Mm-hmm. And honor is a word that has stayed constant. And it's beautiful because it's what it means. Its original meaning is to keep what is true in view.
Hmm.
I love that. Yeah. We need that. We need to reinvigorate and re-inhabit that practice in all dimensions. Because when I honor you and we're friends, that means I keep what I know to be true about you in view, especially when you lose sight of it.
Yeah.
That means I keep what I know to be true. I honor myself, even life. I really feel we need to befriend life. It's not conceptual. It's not something that's inert that we take for granted because it's incomprehensible, and of course the earth. How do we honor? How do we keep what, and again, anyone who's listening, if that speaks to you, how can you practice honoring yourself, your loved ones, the life you're in, the unknown? This is another thing that I think is very troubling in our modern world is that we have catastrophized the unknown. The certainly difficult things can, catastrophe can come and unexpected loss can come and a lot of horrible things, but also beauty, wonder, love, grace, friendship, they all also issue from the unknown. Mm-hmm. After all, I can't think of one person I have been blessed to love or been loved by that I ever planned to meet.
It's a mystery. Huh? It's quite part of the mystery. Exactly. Mark, we're going to take a small break, and while we take this very short break, let us all just think about that. Think of people special in our lives. Think of special connections and relationships that we get to cherish.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Connect at omtimes.com. OM Times, creating a more conscious lifestyle.
With happy clients all over the world, Kara Johnstad knows that your voice is the missing link to more authenticity, abundance, creativity, and health. An internationally acclaimed voice expert, Kara's breakthrough methods have helped thousands of people successfully heal their voice wounds and extinguish the story of self-doubt and shyness forever. Join in group trainings, attend online sessions, schedule one-on-one time, and invite Kara to work with your organization and community. Get started today. Go to www.karajohnstad.com and receive a special guided meditation designed to fine-tune your inner voice and welcome you on the voice journey.
This is Kathy Beal, host of Celestial Compass, featuring astrology you can use. Celestial Compass points you to what's going on in the sky and what you can do with it down here on Earth. We also explore fun, effective, and cosmic tools for navigating this adventure we call life. Join me the first and third Monday of the month at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Celestial Compass. It's enlightening, entertaining, and empowering.
If I could be you,
and you could be me,
for just 1 hour.
If you could find a way
to get inside
each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Welcome back to Voice Rising. Today I am with the acclaimed best-selling author, Mark Nepo, and his new book is called Surviving the Storms, Finding the Strength to Meet Adversity. And he shows us in this book how heart work can deepen us on the journey and help us find faith. And even in our brokenness and the hot mess of life, we can find some beauty and some holiness that's going to bring us back to a sense of connectedness and maybe childlike wonder and appreciation, gratitude for this beautiful life we've been given. You do talk about that a little bit, Mark, in the book. You talk about, you have a chapter where you really share scientifically how amazingly rare it is that we're even on this planet and breathing and in this life at all.
Yes. Yes. Right? You
it's
know, that,
a miracle.
That was such a... It is a miracle, and this really was triggered during the pandemic. I was reading this wonderful, beautiful, dense book by Neil deGrasse Tyson, our contemporary physicist, who he's director of the Museum of Natural History in New York City. And he wrote this book called, tongue-in-cheek. The title was, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. Well, it was anything, but physics for dummies. it was very profound. And in the beginning, he talks about, the tribe of physicists that he's a part of and their sense of how the universe came into being was that as best they can tell, and they, of course, it's all guessing, we're all guessing, but, beautifully that there was this kind of this energy fight, if you will, or contest between matter and antimatter vying for space. And the positive matter was called photons, and the antimatter were hadrons. And when there was 1,000,000,001 photons, positive energy, and 1,000,000,000 hadrons, just one more, boom, the universe came into existence. And he goes on to say that, if the Earth had settled in its orbit a little closer to the sun, there'd be no life because all of the water would have evaporated. If it had settled a little farther away, it would have all frozen and we'd be no life here. And I was so struck by that, we're here by such a small gesture. And so I was reflecting on this, and I think I was out waiting in line at the pharmacy, for some prescription. And all of a sudden it hit me, oh my God, this isn't a description merely of how the universe began. This is a description of how life is an ongoing creation that renews itself every single day. And we are here by the one gesture that outlasts all the rest. And this is the purpose of goodness. The one gesture that the one photon, and the beauty and the kind of humble paradox in the human realm is that we'll never know if it was You know, if you today saw someone, a woman, old woman, fall down outside the grocery store with her bags and you helped her up and got her to her car and helped her, that might have been the one gesture that allowed life to continue today.
Yeah.
And we'll never know, which is why we have to do it anyway. You know, Mother Teresa, one of the things she said was that courage is doing small things with love.
Small things with love. I had to think, too, suddenly about the whole famous, you know, the 100th monkey theory.
Yes.
Just thinking it just takes one more to tip the scale. And knowing what we know about quantum physics, it just takes one more person to drop judgment and live in love, and we might have world peace that fast, right? I mean,
well,
we don't
yeah.
know. I mean, we don't know. It might. We always think that, you know, what can I do? But maybe you're that one breath that chooses love over fear, and that is enough to create a new consciousness on the planet.
Absolutely. Beautifully said. Absolutely. And you know, and I think that, you know, one of the things I discovered in doing research for this book was that, you know, in the Middle Ages in Europe, which we've called the Dark Ages, and actually the rest of the world, I discovered, which I was not taught in school, the rest of the world was actually pretty enlightened at that time. It was just Europe that was going through a dark time. And but during that time, only 10% of the European population was literate. So 10% kept literacy alive for over 300 years.
Yeah.
So if today, despite all of our gifts and our technology, I think we take turns as in any age being awake and being asleep. And while we're awake, it is incumbent on us today to keep the literacy of the heart alive. And we do that by honoring each other, by being that one gesture of goodness, by listening without judgment.
That's very, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's how we do it, right? And we create community circles, and we create listening circles. I wanted to ask you, Mark, I mean, I know this is a very crazy question. We came from this whole technology, and this is now arcing backwards, which is, but I know your mind will be able to follow it. you know, we have in our world, I mean, now we're talking about profound, beautiful acts of kindness, and yet we both know that there are a lot of channels that are throwing out 24/7 violence, whether it's news or video games or movies, and it's all this violence. And my question is for you is, what is the paradox that we are, I mean, I'm in Europe, so, you know, not only do we have the profound, real violence of a war happening now mm-hmm. in Europe,
yes.
and we have the profound, real violence in Yemen, and we have, I mean, there's real violence, and yet, and we're all very touched by this, and we're all very disheartened, and yet we sit and pay millions and billions to watch violence in our living room as a form of entertainment.
Yeah,
and I've never been able to bring these two worlds together, because I don't watch any violence, but I've never been able to understand that. How can we, what is it in us that wants to support that? Yeah.
Yeah. So let me just share my thoughts about that. I don't have any answers, of course, but I feel that historically and also in a deep, deep archetypal way, violence is a last desperate attempt to feel.
Okay.
The need to feel and be authentic doesn't go away. Mm. It comes out sideways. And the more repressed we are, the more divorced, to go back to alienation, the more divorced we are from our human nature, the more divorced we are from each other, the more that we are isolated, not only in our homes by the pandemic, but in the bubbles of technology, the need to be real and authentic and tender and vulnerable, which is how everything in life grows,
yes,
doesn't go away. And so it comes, and so when you literally look at it, you know, when you look, and I had this insight one time because I was seeing this film that became unexpectedly terribly violent.
Yeah.
And I was so jarred that I saw for a moment what's literally happening.
Mm-hmm.
They are literally opening each other. They're forcing to get what's in to come out violently, mm-hmm. because they won't do it by love and by question and honor and listening.
Mm.
So there's a couple of other things about violence I'd like to constellate around this.
Yeah.
And it's a profound question you raise, which is so important. So that becomes a last attempt to feel. And we think this is why, you know, the whole like phenomenon of people who are so divorced from themselves and their own worth cut themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To have proof that I'm here.
They're alive,
because
through all the pain.
And then, of course, that's one thing, but then to do that to others is another mm-hmm. perversion. So let's, for a moment, I want to talk for a moment about the mass shootings mm-hmm. and about the insurrection here in America. So, you know, this epidemic of mass shootings, of course, it's just, you know, obvious. There's just too many guns. It's just absurd. You know, under that too is this: every person who is a mass shooter obviously is the least troubled and ill, and they're responsible for their actions. But we can't say it has nothing to do with us,
mm-hmm.
because I have come to understand mass shooters. As social aneurysms.
Yeah.
So an aneurysm is a cell in the body, a weak cell in the body, that when the body is under high pressure, that weak cell will explode. And it usually leads to a stroke somewhere mm-hmm. or an embolism. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these people are responsible for the horrific things they do. And we're responsible for creating a pressurized social body, because we have an epidemic of weak cells exploding. And in America, it's more than anywhere else. So what have we done, and what can we do to depressurize our society so there are less of these cells will explode?
Which brings us back. I think it brings us really back to the book on the how do we survive? I mean, not only survive, but how do we go through the adversity? And like you say, maybe do the heart work of having personal, spiritual, or embodied, or grounded practices where we can feel alone. Us. Right, without being half on the iPad and alone with us, and then at the same time in a meeting with, and at the same time, the community practice, because we're able to do this. The old world is gone, but what do we want in the new world? Right? Do we want drumming circles? Do we want poetry readings? Do we want the tenderness? Right? The intimacy.
Well, and
that's maybe the question, right?
And great love, regardless of the age, great love and great suffering have been the enormous teachers.
Mm.
And they will humble us with tenderness and with pain and suffering to recognizing that, we're all the same, and we need each other. You know, you know, every society, I think, every culture, like a person, has strengths and liabilities, strengths and shadows.
Yeah.
And in the West, one of our strengths has been the advancement of the notion and the muscularity of a self. And a lot of good things have come from learning about how can we have a healthy, worthy self that connects to everything larger than it.
Mm-hmm.
But the aberration, the shadow of the self, is narcissism, which is a modern, there's an epidemic of narcissism in the modern world. So now you look at like this, the insurrection, which, you know, like many people, I happen to just watch it live on TV. And despite, forget the politics of it, I was watching barbaric violence while people, masses of people, were taking pictures of themselves. They were so dissociated, it was as if they didn't know whether they were in a video game or this was real. And so again, it seems so simple, but it's so profound. How do we restore people's direct? This is real. This is all, there are facts, you know?
If I put they're my hand real in the, people, right? I mean, there are real people that were hurt, and real people died, and real families, real children were affected. And I mean, maybe that's the dichotomy that I'm always struggling with, because I even know people that work in Hollywood, and it's like, yes, but the people want this. They need this violence. And I think most people, actually, they say they don't want it because they don't want war. Most people are very peaceful, loving people. And yet the media and the so-called, you know, what I live also as an artist, seems to be going in that direction. And it's just, you know, it's always this question. It's like if you have the whole grocery store only full of fast food and you don't have any other option, right? Or thank God there's now a renaissance of people that are starting to garden and people that are starting to go to markets. I mean, thank God there are people that, like you said, through suffering maybe does come the awakening of can we be that one act of kindness, or that one person who brings the tomatoes over because they have too many, or get back to that deep connection, which are the deep roots, right?
So here's an amazing thing that I learned about, and this is from the work of, I can't think of his name right now, but he wrote a book about the bonobo and the atheist. And it was about, so he was a primatologist, Franz Duval, I think is his name. And what he did, these experiments, and what he did was they were a form of chimpanzee and another form of chimpanzee is a bonobo. It's a kind of a sister species. Mm-hmm. So what they did was they put two chimps in cages where they could see each other, and they fed them at the same time. And they fed them nuts, and then they fed them grapes, which were more valuable food, more preferred. Mm-hmm. So both get nuts. Then when one chimp got a grape, the other one who didn't threw a tantrum, saying, "Hey, where's my grape?"
Yeah.
But the profound thing is the bonobos, this different species, when they did that with bonobos, the one who was given the grape, the more preferred food, put his grape down and wouldn't eat it until the other bonobo was also given a grape. So even in the primal world of monkeys, we have not only a sense of justice, but of sharing and of equity and of caring for each other. So what has happened to us? And I go back to Marx again, alienation. What has been blocked in us and that we have lost access to our sense of equity and fairness and breaking bread? You know, in my family, my grandfather, who was in the Depression, Great Depression in Brooklyn and New York City, my family. And there was there's a story in our family that during the Depression, everybody was out of work. Nobody had much of anything. And my grandfather would bring strangers home for dinner. And my grandmother would pull him aside and say in her Russian accent, her Russian English, What are you doing? We don't have enough for our kids.
Yeah.
And my grandfather would kiss her on the cheek and say, "Break whatever we have in half, it'll be enough."
Yeah. You see, from that line of kindness and abundance, you come. And for all of those out there, Mark's new book, Surviving the Storms, Finding the Strength to Meet Adversity, has so many gems. I mean, I really, truly have so many, so many poets are woven through this work, so many beautiful insights. One of them, which we'll close the show with, is love coaxes the essence of things more fully into the open. And so may everybody out there really find their true essence. And I guess, you know, like you said in the beginning of the show, just try to find practices that root us so that when the storms are there, the winds move a little bit more easily through and we can hold strong, but together, like your grandpa. Break bread together. Thank you, Mark, so much for being on the show.
Oh, yeah. You're so welcome. Thank you.
Many blessings for you and much success with this new book. It's really a gift for everybody.
Thank you. A joy to be with you. Thank you.